Advanced Studio Classroom is on the air. AI and you, today on Advanced. Hello, listeners, and welcome back to another Advanced Studio Classroom. My name is Simon, and you are joining me in the studio today, along with my co-host, Heather, who is a new co-host for me, but not for Advanced. Hello, Heather.
Hi, everyone. I'm glad to be back.
Heather, there's this phrase I hear people use. It's particularly popular among native Mandarin speakers who are speaking English. It is the phrase, small potato. Do you know what someone is saying when they say they are a small potato?
No, I don't think I've heard that one.
Oh, I'm glad you said that because it is a phrase from English. It's like an English idiom, but it, in my experience, is far more common among non-native speakers than among native speakers. Basically, when you're saying you're a small potato, you're saying like you're an unimportant piece of the story. Hmm. Like you're just a little guy in the story. And, you know, AI is becoming a very big story very quickly. And so today our article is called AI for All. And what we mean by all here is for everybody, even the small potatoes, right?
Yeah.
So AI for me, AI for you, AI for all the listeners today. This, of course, is our September technology article. Heather, would you mind telling our listeners what our subtitle is there?
Who controls the machines that control artificial intelligence?
And this really is the key question of this article, right? Mm-hmm. I guess they're discussing, this is kind of a common topic when people are discussing the pros and cons of AI. We actually use this term later in the article, centralization versus democratization. But they say in the article that that's not exactly the right way to be thinking about it. The question is more like big companies versus startups. Anybody who's small and wants to make use of AI, are they going to be able to? And it talks about some of the challenges involved in that. Heather, do you use AI?
Guilty as charged. I feel like it's becoming kind of inevitable every day. We're all using AI, even if we try to avoid it.
Do you have a favorite?
I'm very basic. I use OpenAI and ChatGPT just for, you know, stuff with work.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Do you use it in your personal life?
I've noticed the more I use it for work, the more it spills over into my personal life. So instead of Googling something, I find that I'm just opening up ChatGPT and asking it questions instead of Googling and finding the information. But it really, I guess, is just contingent on how much time I have.
You're kind of Google's worst nightmare there, I suppose.
I guess so.
Though they're also shifting to AI, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Listeners, if you have your article, I would encourage you, your September magazine, I would encourage you to open it up. We're going to do three readings over the course of this lesson. If you don't have a magazine, I would encourage you to pause the program, run out and get one because, of course, it is the easiest way to support us here at Advanced, and it's good for your English learning experience too. So without further delay, let's do our first reading. We'll do that together now.
AI for All. Who controls the machines that control artificial intelligence? Picture a data center on the edge of a desert plateau. Inside, row after row of servers glow and buzz, moving air through vast cooling towers, consuming more electricity than the surrounding towns combined. This is not science fiction. It is the reality of the vast AI compute clusters that train today's most advanced models. Their performance, energy demands, and costs are comparable to, or beyond, the world's fastest scientific machines. And the implications are just as profound. A recent study of 500 AI compute systems worldwide found that their performance is doubling every 9 months. while both cost and power requirements double every year. At this pace, the frontier of artificial intelligence is not simply about better algorithms or smarter architectures. It is about who can afford, power, and cool these gigantic machines, and who cannot.
All right. Thank you, Campbell, for that reading. Heather, you know, as we were listening to that, I sort of wondered, if we were to get 100 of our listeners and ask each of them to draw a picture of how they picture AI, what do you think they would draw? Like, I would draw my phone.
You would draw your phone.
Yeah, because most of my AI usage is through my phone. Yeah.
Yeah, I feel like that's a fair assessment. I feel like because individual people, we use it on our phones primarily and our computers, we only imagine just that. But it's hard to imagine like the bigger picture of it. And I know in the first paragraph, it kind of gives you an idea of what it actually looks like inside one of those AI data centers.
Yeah. The picture they paint here is not what I think of at all
I
think of AI. Well, I don't think of I guess the word for it would be back end, right? The front end is like the part that you as the consumer or the user are using. The back end is kind of the hidden engineering. And I don't really think about that very much. But that's what they're describing here, right? A data center on the edge of a desert plateau, presumably in the desert because of, you know, I don't know, climate control or cheap land or whatever, right? Inside, there is row after row of servers. By servers, they mean computer servers there, not the people in the restaurant who are bringing you food, obviously. They're glowing and buzzing and moving air through vast cooling towers because, of course, computers run very hot when there are a lot of them together. You have to cool them, consuming more electricity than the surrounding towns combined. So they're basically pointing out here that there's a real climate control issue, there's a space issue, there's an electricity issue. And all of these burdens are important to keep that computer running that supports all of the AI.
Yeah, the description, it feels almost like dystopian when you don't think of the back end like you were saying, and you only think of it in the front end. So that's interesting.
Dystopian, that's an interesting term. What do you mean by dystopian? Are you you're referring to the opposite of the English word utopia?
Am I?
Yeah. So basically there was a book written back. This would be, I'm going to get the century wrong, but I'm going to say the 1600s, called Utopia. It was sort of a famous book in English at the time where it described a perfect country, like a perfect land where everything worked perfectly. It was called Utopia. And so when we use this word utopia, U-T-O-P-I-A, we're describing like a dream world. But the opposite of that is the word you used.
Dystopia, yes.
Yeah.
So I was thinking of it more in the sense of it's futuristic, but so futuristic that it's a little bit bleak and it's maybe mildly depressing, but maybe I'm not using the word correctly.
No, I think you are, because they actually point out here that in the text, they say this is not science fiction. But usually when you read science fiction, you're either reading about like a perfect future, a utopian future, or some of this dark, crowded future urban landscape where everybody's suffering and everything is terrible. And that's dystopian. Yeah. So interesting. You think this server thing sounds dystopian?
Yes. Just like I'm just imagining the rows of just computers and machinery. Maybe it's like a darker room. It's very sterile, not a lot of human contact. And that's why I'm just kind of thinking it's a little bit bleak. It feels a little bit dystopian.
And it's real.
And
because
it's
not
happening.
Science fiction. It's the reality, it says, of the vast AI compute clusters. Now, the compute clusters there, that's basically like where computations are done. That's what computers do, right? They make calculations that are then translated into sort of things we can see, etc. A cluster means a group together. So this is like computers that are in a group together, working together to support the AI. And what do they do? Well, they train today's most advanced models, AI models here being what they're talking about. They then talk about their performance. What do they tell us?
Their performance, energy demands, and costs are comparable to or beyond the world's fastest scientific machines. Mm-hmm. And the implications are just as profound.
Okay. So the energy demands and costs are comparable to or beyond the world's fastest scientific machines. When they say scientific machines, what I think computer. Do you think computer?
I also think like big mega computer, yes.
Like a supercomputer?
That's what I would think, yes.
I always say this term wrong, but I always say NASA. But I think Americans say NASA.
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 How do you say it again?
I don't know why. Maybe it's because I'm Canadian. I always say NASA, but I know Americans say
NASA.
NASA. Mm. Yeah, they say it with kind of an American twist. That anyway, this is one of the ways Americans know I'm not American, right? But I think NASA and the supercomputers it uses to send people to the moon and things like that.
Yeah.
So basically, running the AI on your phone takes as much, if not more, in terms of resources than sending someone to the moon. That's kind of the idea. And the implications are just as profound. So implications mean the effects and
results,
the things that are associated with that are just as profound or important. Mm-hmm. It goes on to say, a recent study of 500 AI compute systems worldwide found that their performance is doubling every 9 months. So they can do twice as much every 9 months, but both cost and power requirements double every year, so every 12 months. Now think about that for just a second. See if you can figure out the implications there. It says, at this pace, the frontier of artificial intelligence. Now hang on, what is a frontier?
The frontier is the limits of what is known about something.
Okay. So it's basically, like I think, the Wild West.
Mm-hmm. It's like the uncharted territory, right?
Yeah, it hasn't been mapped. It hasn't been developed yet. You could say society has not yet impacted it. So it's kind of an uncontrolled place. And so basically what they're saying here is the frontier of artificial intelligence, meaning the new areas that are being developed and rules haven't been established for them yet, is not simply about better algorithms or smarter architectures. So it's not just about like who designs it or whatever. It's also about the resources that it's going to take up and who can afford get enough power for and cool the gigantic machines and who cannot. So they're kind of painting, I think you're right here, kind of a dystopian situation where some people have enough power, mm-hmm. meaning electricity, and money and ability to cool, and other people do not. And so if you don't, you can't run one of these giant data centers. And that, I think, is the essence of the problem. It also brings us to our second reading. So we'll ask Campbell to tell us about the exponential moat.
The exponential moat. When performance doubles every 9 months, but cost doubles every 12, you create an exponential moat. Each leap forward pushes the next frontier further out of reach for all but a handful of players. This is not the familiar story of open source versus closed source models. It is more fundamental. If you cannot access the compute substrate, the hardware, electricity, cooling, and fabs required to train the next generation, you are not even in the race. Universities cannot keep up. Small startups cannot keep up. Many governments cannot keep up.
Okay. So, the exponential moat. What's exponential?
Exponential is the growing or increasing at a faster and faster rate of something.
So I when I think about this, I think back to high school math, and I think about a thing called a logarithmic curve. Do you remember logarithmic curves? You'd have to be a real lover of high school math to have not blocked them out. It's basically when you draw a line on mm-hmm. a graph, and it starts out going up very slowly, mm-hmm. but it gets faster and faster and faster until it's basically going straight up.
Mm.
So it's just like every time you move forward, say a year, mm-hmm. you move to significantly higher on the graph, right? Every time you move a point forward. So that's basically what we're talking about here, where each year you spend doing this, well, each 9 months you spend doing this, you've doubled what you can do with it, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's exponential. And then moat is kind of a word from castles,
mm-hmm.
right? I think of moats as a big ditch that you dig around a castle.
Yes.
To keep people away from it.
Yes, so it can be used that way. How we have it defined in the article is a deep, wide hole dug around an area in a castle used to stop animals from escaping. But in this article specifically, I think they're using it in the business sense, mm-hmm. which means it is an advantage that protects powerful companies from its competitors. So kind of the same idea, like castle has a moat to protect it from either things leaving or things coming in. And in a business sense, they're using this like business moat to prevent other people from getting whatever this company has.
I think if we were to explore this sort of metaphor, we would say that the AI, the level of AI productivity is the castle. And so if you already have the AI, mm-hmm. you're already at the castle, then the castle keeps getting bigger and bigger and more powerful and you have access to it. But if you're starting from nothing, you're a recent graduate of a computer science program and you want to start an AI company, there's a huge barrier between you and that castle level of performance and you can't get to it.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess the way you would think about this is basically if their performance has been doubling every 9 months and they've been doing it for 9 years, then your chance of being able to catch up if you start with your own invention or something is very, very small.
Mm-hmm.
So there's that problem, the problem of productivity, catching up in terms of like the efficiency of the system. But then there's also the issue, of course, of the resources.
Mm.
Because those are also getting more expensive. Like, how do you get enough electricity? How do you pay for the electricity to power one of these hyper-efficient castle-like systems if you're starting from nothing? And so what they say here is basically you've created this moat that pushes the next frontier, so the next achievement in AI, further and further out of reach for all but the handful of players. And those handful of players, those are the people in the castle.
Mm-hmm.
So this is not the familiar story of open source versus closed source models. What are open source models?
So open source models are models that are made freely available for the public to use, modify, and distribute.
Okay. So basically anybody can take it, change it, adapt it, do whatever they want with it.
Mm-hmm.
Closed source means it's kind of controlled by one company or one person, and you have to get their permission. Mm-hmm. To make any changes. So they're saying, though, that this is not that story. So that would be the story of software. You know, like very famously, you have, what's it called, Microsoft Office mm-hmm. versus Linux, right, as operating systems. But this isn't the same sort of situation. Instead, they say it's more fundamental, meaning at a deeper level. If you cannot access the compute substrate... Substrate is like a layer underneath things, basically.
Mm-hmm.
So the unseen part of the AI, which in this case would be the hardware, the electricity, the cooling, and the fabs.
Which is short for fabrication facility.
Okay.
Which is a specialized factory where semiconductors are produced.
Okay, and the semiconductors then go into the chips that you use to run these computers, right? So required to train that next generation. If you don't have access to all of those things, you're not even in the race.
Mm-hmm.
So then they list a bunch of people who are not in the race. Universities cannot keep up. Small startups cannot keep up. Many governments cannot keep up.
Mm-hmm.
So essentially, they're painting a picture here where some people in these big companies in the castle, if you will, are pulling further and further ahead while everybody else is falling further and further behind.
Mm-hmm.
And that brings us to our third reading. Campbell, help us out.
Centralization versus democratization. The rhetoric around AI often emphasizes democratization. Tools made available to everyone, small actors empowered, creativity unleashed. But in practice, the power to shape AI's trajectory is shifting toward the owners of massive compute farms. They decide which models are feasible, which experiments get run, which approaches receive billions of tokens of training. This is not just a matter of money. It is about infrastructure as governance. When only three or four firms control the largest AI clusters, they effectively control the boundaries of the possible. If your idea requires training a trillion parameter model from scratch, and you are not inside one of those firms, your idea remains just that, an idea.
All right, so we're told at the beginning here by Campbell that the rhetoric around AI often emphasizes democratization. Now, rhetoric there, for some of our listeners who've been around for a while, you'll have heard us discuss this before. Rhetoric is kind of a subject that you would see in a classical Western education where you're basically learning the rules and tactics of debate, like how to debate and discuss things. And so here, it's just being used as a shorthand, easy way to say debate. So they're saying the debate around AI is often arguing about democratization.
Mm-hmm.
And that democratization there, that the root word there is the same as for democracy. So the idea just being that if you're in a democracy, everybody gets to vote. If you have a democratized AI system, everybody gets to use it.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, basically, you know, questions of, I don't know if this has happened to you, Heather. I was a big fan of Grok for a long time. It was my favorite AI to use. But over time, there became more and more emphasis, it seemed, on pay models. And there was like a period where if you were using the speak function, like you could basically say two sentences and then it would cut you off and say, you have to try the paid version if you want to use it. That is not democratization because somebody who has the money to pay for it has access to the good features. Someone who does not have the ability to pay doesn't have access. Now, later in the sentence, Heather, they basically tell us why you want democratization.
Well, it says in our article, small actors empowered. And when they say actors, they mean someone who participates in something, and creativity unleashed. And so when something is unleashed, it means to suddenly let a strong force or feeling have its full effect. So when people have access, they can do things creatively and unrestrictively, opposed to, you know, the opposite of
when
that.
When it's locked up.
Yeah, when it's locked up and there's limitations.
I guess the idea being the more people who can use it, the more innovative, different ways you're going to see it used, and then everybody can kind of benefit from that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because, you know, small players don't stay small forever.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you're a small player when you're a student, but that doesn't mean you're going to be like that forever. You might become quite a significant player in the AI world if you have the chance.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of the idea, the argument for it. It goes on to tell us that in practice, the power to shape AI's trajectory, basically meaning the direction that the technology is developing, is shifting towards the owners of these massive compute farms, just because they're the only ones who can afford to basically have the high-end, high-quality AI. So they decide which models are feasible, which models are going to work, which experiments get run, which approaches receive billions of tokens of training. Tokens there, they're basically kind of like the brain cells. It's like how much text the AI can handle, right?
Mm-hmm.
How much it can understand. So
yes.
It's a way of counting how much memory and processing power the AI has. basically. Though the term in other uses kind of means a thing like a coin.
Yeah, that's what I was instantly thinking about is like tangible coin, not something how it's described.
Well, it's interesting because you have to pay for the tokens to get your AI to work. So I think of it as an old video arcade where you put money into the machine to get it to work, and the money would be like a token. So the number of tokens you have determines how much you get to play. So there may be a relationship there between that word use. There may not.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
I have a feeling the guys who run the AI companies spent time playing video games, though.
Yeah, probably. So,
there may be some overlap there. It tells us this is not just a matter of money, though. It's about infrastructure as governance. So what do they mean by that? Infrastructure, we usually think like roads, bridges, things like that. But here, when there's only three or four firms that control the largest AI clusters, that's these computing farms, they effectively control the boundaries of the possible. Because if your idea requires, you know, a lot of computing power, training a trillion parameter model. Parameters are just like, what would you say, variables is the word?
Yeah, it says a variable.
I feel like that's a fairly advanced word. So things that affect the outcome, basically. So you have lots of things that affect the outcome and you have to train a model to do it. So say you're trying to do something very complicated like predicting the weather. You got to think about the temperature, the wind, the terrain, whether there's mountains, all of these things like that. And so if you're trying to do something very complex, you need a lot of computing power. And so if you have a good idea, but you don't have the computing power, really you don't have anything. You just have an idea. Now, listeners, that brings us to the end of this part of our lesson, but it doesn't bring us to the end of the entire lesson. And so Heather and I are going to have to sign off for now, but we hope you'll join us again as we continue talking about AI for all tomorrow. Until then, I'm Simon.
And I'm Heather.
Saying bye for now.
See you later.